Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of April. First hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about financial reform. We have two great guests with us, and this is a story that's going to be with us for quite some time. Yesterday, the Republicans did end their filibuster of Wall Street reforms. The Senate agreed without a vote to begin debate, which could go on for a couple weeks, on a financial regulations bill. President Obama said you should not have to wait another day for protection from some of the practices that got us into the mess. If we don't learn the lessons from the crisis, we doom ourselves to repeat it. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell released a statement saying closed-door negotiations with Democrats on the financial regulations reform bill had ended with agreement on some of the issues, but others were left unresolved. I guess the first half hour of the program today says that the financial crisis and recession cost U.S. households on average of about $100,000 in lost wealth and income. This is from a study from Treasury Department economist Philip Swagel, who is our guest the first half hour. From June of 2008 through March of 2009, household stock holdings fell $66,000. Real estate dropped $30,000. This was released by the Pew Economic Policy Group. Our guest will be talking about how the financial crisis has affected the overall U.S. economy and the possibility for reform of Wall Street. We have a lot on the table the first hour of our program today. Hour number two, something entirely different than what we normally do, comedy. We usually do these shows four times a year. I'm so sorry we haven't done them very often in the last year or so, but today it is comedy from 10 to 11, featuring two of our favorites, Bob and Ray, Abbott and Costello, Jim Gaffigan, George Burns and Gracie Allen, Paula Poundstone, Stephen Wright, Brian Regan, and many others. And we're also asking if you have, and I know this is in the ear of the beholder, a very funny joke. Very funny joke. We ask you to call in the second hour. We'll have time to take a few of those. Philip Swagel is with us now. The first part of our program today, he is a visiting professor at Georgetown University and is former assistant secretary for economic policy at the U.S. Treasury Department from the years 2006 to 2009. He advised Secretary Henry Paulson, Treasury Secretary, on all aspects of economic policy, including current and prospective macroeconomic developments and the development and analysis of the administration's economic initiatives. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Philip, good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, great to have you here. Let's start with this report that you put together here on what happened with the average American household, a huge amount of money lost from that period of time I mentioned. Are things better or not?
It's really incredible just how deep and how severe the impact of the recession and particularly the financial collapse was. And that's what the report that the Pew Charitable Trust put out goes through. And you mentioned some of the numbers. Are things better? It's a mix. The stock market has come back, and so people's equity holdings are back. Housing is not, obviously it's not back. It's probably stabilized, but the housing market remains weak. I think for most people what matters the most is what people feel every day is the job market. And the job market, again, is improving, but it's still weak. We're still, maybe 8 million jobs short of where we were at the end of December. And by my calculation in the Pew study, we lost about 5.5 million jobs just as a result of what I call the acute phase of the crisis, the September and October of 2008.
Mm-hmm. And the president has marked the success of his administration. Actually, it was the first year on the number of jobs that would be created. I would imagine that you feel that he's fallen short, and he must feel that way as well.
Yeah,
or perhaps
it's a tough
not.
Position. I mean, President Obama inherited a, as he likes to say, he likes to use the word inherited, a tough economic situation that, we saw a free fall of the economy in late 2008. And, what I guess what I would criticize, if I could, is the early response, right? He did a massive fiscal stimulus, which I think was the right thing to do. It just, it was very poorly composed, and it wasn't as effective as it could have been. And it kind of just failed to give Americans a boost of confidence that, that the administration had the right plan and right approach for a rebound.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about this as we go on. Let's look at the news now that financial regulation will be debated for at least the next couple of weeks because there are no more filibusters here. How did that happen? What was going on? Was that a political move of some kind, or what was that?
Yeah, it's a mix. You know, the thing that's striking to me about the financial regulatory reform is that there's agreement on so much. I mean, I think, 80% is agreement on, and especially important things like systemic risk regulation, to make sure that there are not firms like AIG that fall through the cracks again, that, no one is in charge of and no one has the ability to get the data from, and that there's agreement on the Federal Reserve is going to have the ability to get the data. There's disagreement on other things, on derivatives, on the non-bank resolution, what happens when there's another AIG or another Lehman, what powers does the government have, and then on consumer protection and things like that. So those are the areas of disagreement still.
And what do you think, as somebody who knows this very well, we need to do in order to keep what happened, a financial collapse almost, from happening again?
Yeah, it's a tough one, and I think we have to have some humility and say there are steps that we can take to try to avoid a similar situation, but be realistic that it's impossible to know every future crisis. So, like I said, giving the Fed in particular the ability to gather more data, that will be useful. Having someone who can, know when to blow a whistle and say, hey, all you banks, AIG is a problem. Stop dealing with them. Don't do more credit default swaps with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example. To me, the key issue now is non-bank resolution. What powers will the government have when inevitably another crisis happens? And it really comes down to a question of how much discretion do you want to give to the government versus how much should there be certainty that banks or other firms will be allowed to fail? And the reason I think this is the key issue is that what happens at the end, in a sense, it works backwards. If you're thinking about lending money to, the next Lehman, if you know that at the end that firm will be allowed to fail and there's no bailout, you're going to think much harder about giving them the money in the first place at the
mm-hmm.
beginning.
Mm-hmm. And what about this knowing when to blow a whistle? Didn't we have enough people around who should have known when to blow a whistle? It's hard to believe that there weren't a lot of people on the case.
No, that's right. I mean, there were cracks in the system or gaps in the oversight. And AIG was one example. Mortgage brokers is another, where those are regulated at the state level, and there wasn't good federal oversight. A broad oversight that the federal government could provide. But I think you're right. I mean, there was a lot of people looking at the industry. A firm like Citigroup, right, was regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency at the banking level. And then the entire company, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, had oversight of. So there are a lot of people looking at it, and yet they still got into trouble. It has to give you pause. Anyone who thinks that giving the government a lot of new power, then, we're done, no more crises, I think that's a little bit too optimistic.
What about the timing of having Goldman Sachs under such intense investigation earlier this week? Did that help to get this thing at least debated?
Yeah, it certainly moved it forward, increased the political pressure. I worry that the long-run impact of that will be the opposite, that the idea of giving the government more power, that sort of is conditioned on the idea that the government is going to use the power wisely or at least not use it maliciously. And, who knows about the facts of the SEC case? It's that's something that come out in court. So far the SEC's best moment was the moment they introduced the case, and pretty much every piece of information since then has looked better for Goldman and worse for the SEC. So I just worry that we're going to give the government more power, and yet there's a demonstration that it might not be used wisely, or might be used for political purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes anyone who says, former Bush guy, blah, 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 you know, remember, these things go in cycles. If you might like the current president, remember in 2 years or in 6 years or, you know, some additional 4 years, there's going to be a different president and a different party, and these powers are not going to go away. Mm-hmm. And so, I think in some ways we have to depersonalize this and, you know, really think at a high level about what power should the government have.
Mm-hmm. When you said, Philip, there's 80% agreement, do you imagine that whatever bill comes forward, that there will be, because we have such great agreement, that we know about 80% of what the bill will be and the other 20% is sort of open to negotiation? And can you talk about what that 80% is and what the 20% that Republicans may object to is as well?
Yeah. So the 80% is, again, the systemic risk regulation. So the idea that there will be a unified body in the government, a new council, that has the ability to get data from any firm and get information from any firm and to, you know, I would say blow the whistle.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that regulators intervene when there's a firm that is taking risky actions. On derivatives, so that's a piece of controversy, but I think the irony is that President Obama's position is much closer to that of the Republicans than the position put forward by Senator Lincoln from Arkansas. So Senator Lincoln's proposal would take derivative trading out of the banks. But there's a reason that that happens in the banks, because those are the institutions that with the expertise and the large balance sheets that are needed to do this. And for example, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, now controlled by the government, do a lot of derivative transactions. So it'd be ironic, right, if this proposal forced parts of the government to do things in a way that's less effective. And you know, look, every time the Treasury Secretary is asked about this, he kind of starts mumbling. So it's clear that President Obama doesn't support his own party's derivatives proposal, and so I count that as an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Consumer protection is the same thing, that consumer protection was fragmented. I think that's going to be more unified. So there's agreement. The disagreement is on precisely how and where.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm speaking for a long time, so maybe I'll stop. I can talk about some of the disagreements next, if you want.
Yes, please.
Okay. So disagreements. So I mentioned the non-bank resolution, and maybe it's worth saying a few more words on that. And it really gets down to, imagine the next Lehman Brothers fails. What can the government do? You know, should that, you know, just call it Lehman. Obviously, it's not going to be Lehman, but the next Lehman fails. Should that firm go into bankruptcy, and should a judge decide, you know, basically how to parcel out the resources, or should the executive branch have the power to put money into that firm? Now, everyone agrees that the shareholders of that firm are going to get wiped out. So, you know, again, agreement. The difficulty is what happens to the creditors, to the people who lent money to the failing firm that got it into trouble in the first place.
Okay.
In a bankruptcy process, those creditors would take losses. And so, okay, so that's one poll. There's no discretion, bankruptcy, you know, judge divides it up. The Senator Dodd's bill, and the same thing with Chairman Barney Frank's bill in the House, would give the government power to put money into that firm without a vote of Congress. So, you know, creditor, you know, hedge fund was supposed to get 30 cents. The government can put in money and give them 31 cents instead. And to me, that is the essence of a bailout. The government can put money in and say, okay, you know, creditor A, hedge fund A, I like you, you're going to get 31 cents. Hedge fund B, I don't like you, you're only going to get the 30 cents you're supposed to get. It's a huge grant of discretion. There's no vote of Congress. There's no oversight. And to me, that's a big problem, and that's going to be a big point of disagreement.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about financial regulation, which will now be debated on the Senate floor. an agreement to at least let debate begin. Our guest says there is about 80% agreement on what should be in financial regulation and outlined what the agreements are and what the disagreements are. Philip Swagel is our guest, the first part of the program. He is a visiting professor at Georgetown University in the School of Business and is former Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the U.S. Treasury Department, where he was from 2006 to 2009. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Rick from La Crosse. Hello, Rick.
Yeah, I'm kind of upset right now because we need regulation, okay? And I don't think the gentleman is being too honest about what was before. There was a firewall between investment banks and commercial banks, the Glass-Steagall Act. It prevented commercial banks from speculating and speculative banks from commercializing. And basically what's going on is that the Glass-Steagall Act, as it was called, it was a Depression-era legislation, set up this firewall between the two kinds of banks, and it was repealed under a Democratic administration at the behest of the Republicans, of course. But, well, so there's no firewall anymore, and the commercial banks can do whatever they want with other people's money, and basically that's what got us into the problem that we're in right now. And so we need to bring that back. We need to bring that kind of regulation back so that, you know, that people's money deposits are not compromised. And I don't hear the gentleman saying that this needs to be brought back. I don't see the gentleman saying that the Glass-Steagall Act needs to be brought back, and it should be brought back.
Philip.
Okay, yeah, it's an interesting point, and I'm going to agree and disagree in part. I had a sort of one observation, which is, the country is so divided now, and one of the things that's really unfortunate to me is, in some sense, saying someone who disagrees with me that their opinion is dishonest or illegitimate. And so I just, you know, it's just an observation saying that someone else is being dishonest because they don't agree with you. So I'll tell you where I agree and where I disagree. The Glass-Steagall repeal under President Clinton, that allowed banks to get into more activities and into riskier activities. And so I agree with the caller. You know, it didn't break out cleanly, though, among which banks got into trouble. So, for example, Citigroup, moved across the Glass-Steagall line, so to speak, and got into trouble. But J.P. Morgan Chase did the same thing and didn't. In the investment banks, Bear Stearns did not move across the line, right? Glass-Steagall was repealed, but Bear Stearns didn't take advantage of the repeal. They got into trouble. Lehman Brothers the same, whereas Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley didn't. And so it doesn't cleanly break out along the lines of the Glass-Steagall repeal. So that's where I disagree. I do agree, though, that we have to look carefully at the activities of the banks, and that would be the useful part of giving regulators more power and really more empowerment to use their existing authority to say when a bank is undertaking activities that are risky, some action has to be taken. And so I wouldn't kind of do it bluntly like Glass-Steagall, but I'd look carefully at the activities of each institution.
Can you comment, Philip? Let's look at the issue of trust here. It seems to me as though the American people, many Americans, have a real concern about who is looking fairly at this whole issue, that there's so much interlap between people who are trying to regulate now, getting campaign contributions, and that's Democrats and Republicans from Wall Street, that you've got all these Wall Street people who are in the Obama administration now, too. And I think that there's a lack of trust that our interests are going to be first and foremost.
Yeah, it's a really difficult issue, and the lack of trust is on so many levels with the government, where the regulators, as you pointed out before, had power and didn't you know, didn't notice and didn't stop it, you know, on the sort of political level or the campaign contributions. And, you know, even at the firm where, you know, I think one of the most serious pieces of the SEC case for Goldman is not necessarily the illegal versus illegal, you know, I'm a bit skeptical, but whether Goldman's clients will trust the firm in the future. And to me, that's the real danger for it. And I'm not sure exactly how we regain that trust. It's, you know, somehow the government has to be able to show the American people that it's in control of the situation, both, you know, using its powers wisely and, you know, not using its powers when it's better not to. And I think it's just going to take time for us to have more confidence and for that trust to be rebuilt.
Does it also call for a change of players?
You know, it's a tough one. Some of the players, I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for. I have a lot of respect for Secretary Geithner. I have a lot of respect for Chairman Bernanke and the bank regulators. And so it's not, you know, it's not that the people we have are not excellent. It's, you know, good people can make mistakes. And in some sense, that's one of the aspects of the financial crisis was that so many people made so many mistakes. You know, if we went after everyone who made mistakes in housing, we're going to, you know, we're going to be spending a lot of time on it and need a lot more courthouses. So it's, it's a tough one. I think we just have to understand human failings and, you know, try to prevent the crises, but understand that we're not going to prevent them all. And think seriously about what to do when the next crisis comes and what should the response of the government be.
Right. Ron from Sparta is next. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning. I have two questions, one about derivatives that's going to be second. The first one I got is, as a taxpayer, the people who work for the SEC, their computers were studied. 30 to 40% of them spent over 8 hours a day looking at pornography. And how can we trust and give them more responsibility when they aren't doing their job now and haven't been doing their job? If we're paying people to look at pornography, they sure don't belong on payroll in a government office.
Where did you get this?
Of them should be fired.
Where did you get this information, Ron?
Where do I get my information? Off of Greta Wire or Fox News? And they had documented hours.
This is really it's a scandal that the government workers were doing this, and this really it really looks bad for the SEC. You know, most of the SEC workers are upstanding, and you know, the small number, but it's really it's a terrible thing. But so I'm agreeing with you, but most government workers are hardworking and honest and trustworthy. So. But anyway, I'm sorry. So keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Derivatives. How do we, as taxpayers, in this bill, is there something to stop the guaranteed insurance of derivatives that caused AIG to fail and us to bail them out? Is there anything in there that stops that? It's like betting on something to fail, and then they're guaranteed a payoff. I might as well go to the casino and bet, if I get insurance covers it, I got nothing to lose, as long as the taxpayers pick up the bill.
And that's to me, that is the most difficult issue: is what makes a firm too big to fail, and when will the government step in? So let me start. So derivatives have some socially useful purposes, and for any farmer, any commodity user, they want to hedge risk. There's a useful purpose. But this useful purpose is even broader. You know, imagine a community bank. So you said you're in Sparta, but imagine anyone, Eau Claire, Wausau, whatever, any of the bigger communities near there, La Crosse. A community bank in that town is going to be very long on housing, right? They're going to be making lots of loans to people in the La Crosse neighborhood, and they might want to diversify their risks. And one way a bank could do that is to use a derivative to go short on housing, right? So they're very, quote, long on housing. They have many loans for housing, and use a derivative to offset that risk. And so that's a kind of socially useful function, and then someone has to be on the other side of that derivative, okay? So that's the worry, is that it's very difficult to say which part of financial innovation, such as derivatives, is socially useful and which part is not. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, and I'll be very quick, very brief, is how do we avoid bailing out, like the gentleman said, a firm like AIG that gets into trouble? And to me, that is the tough issue. I come out on the side of a bankruptcy solution. At the end, you say, we will not bail firms out. They will fail. A judge will divvy them up. And then hopefully, at the beginning, that means the people who get into business with the firm will know that there's not going to be a bailout for them at the end, and will behave in a less risky way at the beginning.
And we'll take one more, if you have time, just one more call, Philip. Is that okay?
Okay, sure. And I'll be very quick. I'm sorry.
Are you from Wisconsin? You know your geography very well.
You know, my wife's family is from Wisconsin. So I was married in Madison, and our oldest son has gone to summer camp up in Conover. So, lots of Packer fans in my house, even though we live in Maryland.
Okay. Anne from Madison. Hi.
Hi. There's a great article in April 17th issue of the New York Times, Saturday. It explains exactly what synthetic collateralized debt obligations are. And I don't think the average Joe, at least I didn't, you know, has any idea of how complicated these concepts are.
Right.
But I wanted to say that the public, the average public, member of the public, pays his or her taxes. They have to pay them right on time. If you pay your property taxes at 12:45 on the deadline day and it's not postmarked till the next morning, the average Joe will be charged something like 10.5% of the last 6 months of their property taxes as interest and penalty. The average guy, if he steals $5 and he lives in Texas, can spend the rest of his life in prison. And yet, you know, so deregulation, which was became law under President Clinton, is only applicable to the very, very rich, the guys who are able to influence policy by giving huge amounts of money to our politicians. And I think until we recognize that deregulation is a it's not a sincere idea. It's basically it's a transfer of wealth to the very rich, and we definitely need something like the Glass-Steagall Act back.
Philip.
Yeah, you know, again, I would say it's a tough one, that deregulation or regulation is a balance between which powers the government should have, because giving the government too much power can cause a problem. You know, so imagine, for example, the previous caller's question about the bailouts for AIG. Imagine that the government has the power in Senator Dodd's bill to, it's basically an unlimited bailout power is in Senator Dodd's bill. So, you know, the next Lehman fails or the next AIG fails, and the government has the power to put money in and bail them out, at least bail the creditors to that firm out. If you're in the government, you might be very tempted to use that power because you worry about, well, if I let Lehman fail, all chaos is going to break loose, and that's going to hurt millions of Americans. And that might be the right thing to do, but it might not be the right thing. And in some sense, prescribing the powers of the government might help influence behavior of the lenders to that firm in a way that makes the whole system less risky. So, you know, look, I'm not saying that we just need to deregulate and the market. So I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we really need to think carefully about the balance of powers that you give the government and the role of the government in our society. So it's a bigger picture question, but I think a lot of that is what's involved in the discussions of regulatory reform.
Philip, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time
really
this
pleasure.
Morning.
Thanks
thank
very much.
You. Philip Swagel, visiting professor at the School of Business, Georgetown University, former Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the U.S. Treasury Department from 2006 to 2009. We're continuing conversation about financial reform, and it will now be on the floor, debated for some time by the Senate. Joining us this half hour is Daniel Indaviglio, a blogger and editor for the Atlantic Business Channel, a former writer for Forbes, and investment banker consultant for financial services firms. He wrote a very interesting piece, trying to find the date here, recently, we'll get the date in a moment, in the Atlantic on the good and bad of the Republican financial reform alternative. And, of course, he's writing extensively about this whole issue, which is very much front and center. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Thanks for your call, Ann. Our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Daniel, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest the last half hour said that Republicans and Democrats would agree, this almost sounds like healthcare reform again, on 80% of what needs to happen to regulate the financial industry. Would you say that that's about the case?
Yeah, I mean, it might even be more. I mean,
really?
Yeah, there seems to be the interesting thing about the Republican plan that came out this week is that there seems to be a lot more agreement than disagreement. It really gets down to the details, I think, where there's some disparity.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, what are the good Republican financial reform alternatives? And actually, our other guest was saying that there are certain things that the president would agree with the Republicans on and not the Democrats.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Actually, the Republicans' version looks a lot more like the House version than the Senate version, and the House version does resemble exactly what the White House kind of wanted. So a couple of the things that I would outline as the good things that the Republicans want to do, one is with derivatives. They want a little bit less of an aggressive approach when it comes to derivatives. In the Senate bill, we're told that they would have big banks, all banks actually, spin off their derivative desks. They would have to be required to get rid of the derivatives business in order to obtain any kind of assistance from the government, which would even include depository insurance, which obviously every bank needs because it's very important. So that's something that the Senate version wants, but it's really highly controversial because there's many reasons why it's good for banks to remain in that business, because it would be kind of detrimental to the derivatives business if they weren't there. Another thing that makes a lot of sense is for the financial stability function, for the big systemic risk regulator that everyone pretty much agrees that we should set up, a difference is that the Republicans don't want to have a sort of list of regulated firms, you know, kind of these are the 20 big firms that this regulator cares about, because there's a fear that the market will view those firms as sort of too big to fail and they'll get preferential treatment when it comes to debt funding and that sort of thing. Republicans don't want a list. They want to have the same kind of regulator do the same kind of things, but they don't want to have specific firms kind of known as, you know, these are the systemic really risky firms that will be regulated. And then something that the Democrats don't want to do that Republicans are more interested in doing right now is regulation for the GSEs, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac institutions, who played a huge part in the financial crisis and the mortgage boom. Both versions of reform in the House and the Senate failed to mention the GSEs entirely. The Republicans, it's a big issue for them. They want to have more oversight for these guys, wind down their business to some extent, and limit the amount of taxpayer bailouts that would be incurred by them.
This is such, I guess the bill is, 1,300 pages long. This is a very complicated bill, isn't it, for those of us who don't know a whole lot about economics? You really need a background in this to understand the minutiae of regulation.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's complicated for even those of us who do understand. It's a lot of stuff in here. I mean, you know, unless you work in derivatives or, you know, work in mortgage-backed securities or something like that, it's definitely complicated and hard stuff.
Right. Well, tell me how it deals with the things that many people are concerned about, and that's the value of their housing and not wanting their most prized possession to become worthless, almost. People who are worried about a lot of dishonest people who are taking our money and doing God knows what with it, and as a result, we've lost a lot of money, or we bailed out. We gave them a lot of taxpayer funds, and then they rewarded themselves with our money. How does any kind of financial reform deal with the concerns of us?
Right. Well, there's a number of different provisions. I would say one kind of big overarching one that it seems like both parties are now on board with is this idea of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency.
They are now.
Yeah, the Republicans kind of have been on board with it for a while. They have, again, some differences in sort of the details. Republicans, for some reason, have a fear that what they call prudential regulation, which would be that big systemic regulator that worries about, you know, big economic questions, could be overshadowed by the Consumer Protection Agency, and as a result, bad things could happen. I've written that I don't really see how that conflict would arise, but it's something that concerns Republicans.
But in any case, that's certainly one thing that would help. That way consumers would have a kind of a big advocate out there to make sure that they're not taken advantage of in certain ways. One interesting Republican proposal that we don't see in anything from the Democrats yet is they would actually, for mortgages specifically, because you mentioned housing, they would actually have specific, what are called underwriting requirements, sort of things that mortgages have to do to ensure better safety. In other words, one example might be a down payment of 10%. I mean, that's not a specific example they say, but that's the kind of thing that they would have. They'd have certain government guidelines of things anyone writing a loan has to do to make that loan safer. Democrats don't really have anything that specific, but their Consumer Financial Protections Agency may ultimately outlaw certain kinds of mortgages that turned out to be very risky, like those option adjustable rate mortgages that people had that ballooned to insane levels and caused lots of foreclosures. So there are definitely provisions in there for the average American that will hopefully help.
Okay. Let's welcome phone calls for you momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this half hour, Daniel Indaviglio, blogger, editor for the Atlantic Business Channel, former writer for Forbes, investment banker, and consultant for financial services firms. We are looking at financial regulation. It will be debated now in the Senate for probably quite some time, next couple of weeks at least. We're looking at what's in it, what the Democrats and Republicans agree on, what they don't agree on, and what will benefit you. To you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to have our comedy show. We've tried to do these spring, summer, autumn, fall, or I mean autumn, winter, but we haven't for a while, and so I'm looking forward to it. We're going to laugh. We have some classic comedy. Who's on first? We'll have to play. It is baseball season. Some Bob and Ray, and since we did our first comedy show, they've become among my favorite comedians. They're just so dry and smart and fun. And we'll hear from Jim Gaffigan, Paula Poundstone, George Burns and Gracie Allen, Stephen Wright, his great streams of consciousness, Brian Regan, who thinks we need to teach spelling rules differently. And we're just going to have a good time. And we're also asking you, we'll have time for a few phone calls. So if you have a fabulous joke that's not really long and that we can hear on the radio and that we all think is funny with all those qualifications, call in with your joke or you can send us an email as well. We go to phone calls now. Let's go to Bill from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
I hear a lot of people talking about whether, the big debate is whether to regulate, how much to regulate, what kind of regulations. But the one thing that no one talks about is antitrust. It seems to me like this was a quaint concept that is still on the books, but nobody has enforced meaningfully in at least 20 years. And it seems to me that if a company is, quote, too big to fail, it is too big to exist in the first place.
Interesting question.
Does antitrust have any bearing here? Is that the problem? I'd like to listen to your guest's response over the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure, that's a great comment. And some economists have suggested that. Some prominent economists, a guy named Stiglitz and another guy named Simon Johnson, are both have made those arguments that antitrust should, in fact, be used here. Obviously, the idea of antitrust is to create fairness by limiting kind of monopolistic behavior. And what they argue can sometimes happen with these large institutions is due to their size, due to their becoming too big to fail, they will end up having a competitive advantage, which is exactly the kind of thing that you want to avoid with monopolies. So their argument is antitrust law should, in fact, be used to break up these institutions, to forbid certain mergers that would create giant banks, financial services companies. So that argument has been used. With that said, there's not widespread support in Congress for the idea. So at this point, it's more of a kind of a fringe theory. Now, there are some in Congress who do just in theory agree with breaking up the banks, but that generally isn't in the context of antitrust law. But that idea has been suggested, and there are people who think that makes a lot of sense.
And why isn't there great support for it when at other times in U.S. history there has been?
I guess it's just one of those things. It's very controversial. I mean, breaking up any company is kind of hard politically to do because you have firms that are that are there, and a lot of, well, and to be a little cynical, you know, a lot of these firms have a large lobbying force in Washington. There are a lot of people who think that you're messing with the free market, even though free market economics does really say that antitrust behavior is very important. So I guess it's just very controversial, and it is hard to prove just precisely what sorts of costs are lesser due to firm size, because there are certain requirements with antitrust law that there have to be clear problems in the market that would result from this problem, specifically due to costs, cost controls, and that sort of thing. So it's a little bit hard to prove the materiality, and that's why it's a hard case to win and hasn't been done up to now. But you know, in theory, it's not impossible. That it
right. Let me ask you about interchangeable players here, as I asked our last guest. There is some concern that you got the same people benefiting from campaign contributions who are coming up with this legislation. You got people who are supposedly now regulating Wall Street when they were members of Wall Street. Does anybody really have the consumer, the American voter, who's speaking up for us?
That's a good question. I mean, there are groups that do lobby for consumers and workers and that sort of thing. That's a constant struggle in Washington. I mean, yeah. Having politicians be certain that, or having, I guess, the public being certain that politicians aren't too swayed by businesses with a lot of money is difficult, because obviously they have to run campaigns and they're very concerned about re-elections, so that can go a long way. Yeah, I mean, there's no good answer, unfortunately, right now. It's hard. It's a hard situation.
We go to Alyssa next from Kenosha. Hi, Alyssa.
I was curious about whether, how some of the big points in this bill compare to what other countries do to regulate. And I was wondering, considering that this crisis started in this country and then spread all over the world, I would figure that other countries might be pretty interested in what in this bill and what their opinion is of it.
Yeah. A lot of the problems that occurred during the financial crisis were very new, really, to the whole globe. I mean, we hadn't seen a sort of enormous housing crisis with such a huge bubble for some time. So, frankly, a lot of the regulatory measures that other countries had taken wouldn't probably have solved the problem either. And that's one of the reasons there was so much contagion, why so many other countries had problems as a result of ours. A lot of other countries were also experiencing it. I think Britain also had a housing bubble going, just like we did, for example. So there really wasn't any answers to be had. However, as you alluded to, a lot of other countries are ramping up their regulatory efforts as well, just like we are. So there is definitely a lot of action in sync here. One area in particular that heavily touched on in this conversation has been capital requirements, which is also a big concern. One of the problems with the banks was they didn't have enough capital on hand to cover the big losses that resulted from bad mortgage bets. So that's why they had to go to the government kind of hat in hand, because they needed money to cover their costs, to cover, you know, their capital liquidity and all that sort of thing. And capital requirements is a big global issue. And one of the reasons, or one of the purported reasons, why you don't see specific capital requirements in any of the bills in Congress, even though that's a very sensible and well agreed upon change that needs to be made, is because it's considered a global effort. The G20, the group of 20 nations, and those sort of global groups are conferring on capital to try to think of what global standard would make sense, because there's a concern amongst nations that if certain countries have higher capital requirements than others, that their banks will be at a disadvantage. So they do want to have a similar level amongst nations.
Mm-hmm. The debate in the Senate will begin in full force now. And is it likely, is it such a complicated bill that this debate's going to go on for a long, long time, do you think?
Well, you know, I actually don't think it will, mostly because this is such a hot topic right now, and people are so concerned about financial regulation, and you know, all the Goldman Sachs news has brought it to the forefront of society right now, that it's very politically toxic to kind of be against it. And that's one of the reasons it seems that Republicans, even though they have concerns, some of which are probably legitimate, have been seen coming around more quickly than people thought. Because the idea that, you know, it's already been 18 months or more since the financial crisis and nothing has really been done to change the system is a concern to so many people. So I think what we'll see is relatively quick movement. We'll see, you know, some debate, as you mentioned, probably for at least a couple of weeks. But it's hard to believe that Democrats would allow this to be dragged out too much longer. That's one of the reasons Senator Dodd kind of pushed this out of his banking committee so quickly. People thought that it would remain in that committee for several weeks and was pushed out in a matter of days because there was a concern about timing. So I think you'll see a lot of pressure on Washington to kind of get this done sooner than later. So I don't think it's at all unbelievable that you could see a bill finalized by even, you know, as soon as late June, early July.
Why didn't the president take this up sooner?
Well, and that's another great question people have asked. A lot of people have said that if he had taken it up sooner, it would have been politically easier because the crisis would have been, you know, fresher in people's minds and there would have been more of a drive to do it. And really, it just boils down to political priorities. The president was very concerned with getting health care reform done, and that was the priority in his mind. And I guess I don't think they realized how difficult it would be to make that happen. And once they kind of got on that train, it was hard to switch gears before it was brought to completion. So once it was, then the clear push was financial reform. So I guess it was kind of, in a way, the second priority, and the first took a lot longer than they thought, I would think. So that's the, you know, the answer,
that's
I guess.
That's it. 800-486-8655 is our phone number. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to talk about financial regulation and the debate in the Senate. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Now, there is, I think there is a House measure that's not quite as stringent as what the Senate is looking at, although we're not completely sure what they're going to look at. But these two would have to be reconciled. Last December it was passed. Can you talk just a little bit about the House bill?
Sure. Yeah, again, there are a lot of similarities, but as you mentioned, there are some significant differences. One pretty major difference that I may have mentioned was that the House bill for the derivatives isn't nearly as aggressive. They mm-hmm. wouldn't require banks to spin off their derivatives desks and that sort of thing. So that's one major area, and that's one major area of Republican contention as well. Another way in which it's different, and you know, when you get into some of the details, you find more differences, which are concerning to people, but probably not the average person. One difference is they both have this idea that there should be a giant resolution authority out there to unwind large financial firms that get into trouble, kind of like AIG had. The House version, and both of them have bailout funds, both of them have bailout funds in order to pay for costs involved in those wind downs. And both of those versions would create those funds, not on taxpayer money, but on money assessed to the large financial firms that it would unwind, ultimately. One major difference is the size. Senator Dodd's bill would account for about a $50 billion fund, while the House version would include a $150 billion fund. And there's some concern that, well, and there's kind of concern across the board. Some people don't like the idea of a fund at all, while some people think $50 billion isn't even enough. So there's kind of a wide spectrum there. But that's an ongoing
right.
debate and a big difference. What are some other differences? I think there's the Federal Reserve would have greater attention by the House version. There's a lot of people who are calling for audits of the Federal Reserve to have greater oversight on the kinds of things they do. I think the House version is a little bit more aggressive in doing that than the Senate version. The Consumer Financial Protection Agencies are a bit different as well. The House version would have a truly independent agency, while the Senate version would have it housed within the Federal Reserve. Another difference is with the makeup of that Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The Senate version would have kind of one head who would control the whole thing, while the House version would have a sort of board of leaders that mm-hmm. would control the consumer financial regulation.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I just want to get a sampling here.
Sure.
We have a ton of phone calls and just a couple minutes left. Kurt is next from Greenwood. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm going to suggest I have kind of, hopefully not too lengthy a comment, that the situation we and the whole globe has gotten into has been the consequence of, what shall we say, everything post-Marx economists who have, you know, with vaguely referred to as a free market, exemplified in politics by Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and their global counterparts, which despised public oversight through government control of the economy, just just let human greed and ingenuity, the good and the bad, pursue its course, and everything would come out good, and we've seen what's happened there. And Congress now is, with their suggestions, acting more like EMTs, emergency medical technicians, when what we need is radical surgery. I'm suggesting that the global economy as it is now is built on the myth of ever-increasing values based really on nothing except presumption that the numbers stand for something. And maybe we should, as far as an economic pattern or school of thought or ideology, look again at raw materials economics and curbing greed.
Okay. Daniel?
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely, you know, a big debate that's been strengthened a lot with, as you mentioned, what's gone on lately. There's even one of the problems was even a lot of the regulation out there kind of wasn't used during the financial crisis. I mean, the SEC, a lot of people kind of complained that the SEC really sat on its hands. It wasn't enforcing kind of existing regulations even out there. So there is definitely a lot of people who would agree with that things just got out of hand. I mean, the market became too free, if that's possible, because you do need some government oversight to worry about people who will try to take advantage of the system, who will not worry about consequences and worry more about short-term success versus long-term viability and that sort of thing. So I think that the push does kind of envision that idea that the free market was too free. So I think that's definitely a popular idea.
Daniel, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Our guest this part of the program, Daniel Indiviglio. He's a blogger and an editor for the Atlantic Business Channel, former writer for Forbes, investment banker and consultant for financial services firms. And we also thank Philip Swagel, who is a former assistant secretary for economic policy at the U.S. Treasury Department, for being our guest this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Total break. We're going to just laugh, I hope, the next hour of the show. This is the Ideas Network.